Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Porto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Porto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Porto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on Radio Free Palmer, radiofreepalmer.org, 89.5 FM in the Mat-Su Valley, up here in the state of Mushing, the state of Alaska. And on the line, we have four-time Iditarod champion and just a recent finisher of the 2012 Iditarod, coming in 19th place, Martin Booser. Martin, how's it going this evening?
It's going good. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Enjoying the weather up there in Big Lake.
Oh, it is a sunny evening, and it's extremely clear. We call it severe clear. We can see about as far as one can see, and you can almost see the snow disappearing as we speak.
And it is melting fast. I live up in Willow, and we still have a couple of feet on the ground up there, but it's melting pretty quickly. And I drove down here to Palmer, and we can finally see some of the grass coming up here on the side of the road. So it's definitely going to be a very quick spring for us up here in the Mat-Su Valley.
Yeah, I bet you people will start playing golf here before too long, especially in Palmer, where the snow goes the first.
There you go. Well, thank you very much for joining us. I know everybody that knows anything about mushing knows exactly who we're talking to this evening. But if you will, for our brand-new listeners here in the Valley, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, Martin?
Okay. My name is Martin Booser, and I guess one of the tests I undergo every year is the annual Iditarod sled dog race. I have, over the years, become a professional dog musher. Of course, Iditarod is the flagship event of the dog mushing sport, and I have been fortunate enough to enter that race 29 times and finish the race just as many times. And over the years, I've done some good racing and some not so good racing. So I think people might remember I have won a few, but really what I hope people will remember is the approach to the dogs and what we do with them, not only on a two-week basis on the Iditarod, but on a year-round basis.
And that's going to be our focus this evening. I really want to get into talk a lot about raising the puppies the right way. I know we've talked about that a lot on this show with other guests. We've had several Iditarod mushers on in the last few weeks, and I'm very interested in hearing your unique approach to raising your puppies from well before they're born. I think that's a very key component of this. But before we get into that, Martin, when did you get started into mushing? And if you could, share us that first couple of experiences. What in the world have you done to catch that mushing bug?
It was somewhat coincidental. Hearing me speak, you might realize that I have a bit of an accent, and that means I was born and raised in Switzerland. And as a teenager, I stumbled upon a dirty bunch of people. They were literally covered from head to toe in mud, and their only white parts of their bodies was their smiling teeth. And that was intriguing to me. I went over and asked, "What the heck are you guys doing?" in a different language, of course. And they said, "Well, we just got done training our sled dogs, and tomorrow we're going to do that again. And if you're interested, you're more than welcome to get dirty with the rest of us." And that was intriguing enough to me. I think it was a Saturday. So Sunday I came back to that very same spot, and the people ended up putting me on a really weird contraption. It was a buggy made out of a Volkswagen chassis, and it had no motor and no windshield, and literally only had the seats and steering wheel and the brakes left. And they hitched up a bunch of Siberian Huskies in front of that cart, and off we went, racing and traveling through the mud and the bog and the trees and the woods. And at the end of the day, I was dirty like the rest of them and had my smiling face on, and that was the only clean part on my face, my teeth. So that was the first introduction to working sled dogs. And at the end, of course, the observation was made, I don't know who likes it more, the dogs or the drivers. And that sort of, I say that was maybe the, I gave it my pinky and then my hand was sucked in, and then sooner or later my left arm was all part of it. And before I knew it, I was spending all my spare time and all my waking moments were spent at those people's kennel with the infatuation that these dogs, you know, spark in people. And then during my teenage school years and later my early 20s, of course, I had to go to school and eventually had to go to the military service, like is so customary in Switzerland. And then after all the so-called command performances were done, I decided to go to Alaska for a year and learn more about sled dogs. And since I had dabbled in the sport, I certainly wanted more adventure, but I had no intention whatsoever to make it my livelihood or even to run the Iditarod. That sort of just kind of fell in place as I came here and ended up working with people.
And what year was that, Martin?
I came to Alaska in 1979 for a year, and that tells you how slow of a learner I am. I'm still here, so it's well over 30. It's well over 30 years now, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to stay. I have certainly fallen in love with not only the state, but ultimately the country as well. And I readily say that I'm living the American dream.
And that you are. And if we could just spend a minute or two talking about the 2012 Iditarod, one of the most iconic moments, at least on video and on pictures, of course, on the Internet and Facebook, and how that explodes very rapidly in race coverage over the last couple of years, is you coming into Nome under the arch right there with your son, Roan. He finished 18th, you finished 19th. If you could share that moment with us for folks that watch that on the video or watch that on Facebook, it's got to be a proud moment to see, you know, see your son that you know, grew up pretty much in your back pocket there in the mushing kennel, finish right there along with Dad.
Of course, I beg to differ with you, and I beg to differ with the Iditarod that I finished 18th and he finished 19th. And of course, as a matter of course, we really wanted to have a draw, but I think I might have rubbed the race committee wrong a few times by making my own rules or implementing rules. So they gave Roan the extra $2,000 and called him the 18th finisher and myself the 19th finisher, even though I had assurances from the race marshal that it was going to be a tie, but their record keeping might not allow a tie. So it was certainly a highlight. We really were hoping it would be first and second, not 18th and 19th, but that is an entirely different story. We had quite a few challenges along the way, but from a humanistic, from a father and son, or from a family, or from a business point of view, it was quite a unique event and adventure and pleasure to be traveling with my son. This was his second Iditarod, and we really had a good time pretty much from start to finish. We readily admit, of course, that any time you run 1,000 miles, you have highs and lows. And if you have a good buddy to travel along, you can pick him up when he's got a lull and vice versa. So we fed off each other really well and had a good trip to Nome.
And that's got to be a great experience for both of you. I know you were itching that for that first and second place, but you know, if you have that time to spend out there on the trail with your son, that's got to be a special moment. And you know, as a dad, I would be privileged and honored to travel down the trail with my son as well. So I want to congratulate you on that 29th race. As you mentioned, you ran it 29 times and you finished 29 times. So that's got to be quite a feat in itself. But let's get into the topic of today, if we can, Martin, and that's about raising those puppies. And as we talked about off air before we went on, I heard you speak at the Willow Dog Musher Symposium this past, I guess it was September, October, whenever it was, up there in Willow, and you shared a segment with the audience about raising puppies. And I know that's a big part of your kennel. I was wondering if we could share that with our listeners this evening.
Okay, well, I of course, I don't remember what I said when. But since I never tell anything that I don't really do, I might repeat myself. And if I don't go in the direction you think I should be going, you just let me know. But one of the things I tell people, I have lots of opportunity to share my experiences. One of the terms I use for my dogs is designer dogs, because if you're a well-organized kennel, you have the blatant ability to pick the moms and the dads, and that, believe it or not, has a lot to do with raising puppies. So you obviously want to pick the dogs that, what I call, have the 30 attributes. Most people will concentrate on an attribute or two, and that's good enough for most purebred dogs. They might have to retrieve, and they might have to be black, and you get a black Labrador, you know, or they might have to hold their right foot up and stick their tail out, and you might have a pointer. Our dogs are a bit more complex. Our dogs have to have about 30 attributes in their favor before they're ever considered breeding material. And a few of them, of course, are quite obvious, you know, toughness, endurance, maybe speed, maybe you know, eating habits. Those are all obvious attributes that the dogs need to have. But if they're not well socialized, if they're not friendly, if they're not leader material, if they're not good in the nighttime, the daytime, the uphill, the downhill, the deep snow, the soft snow, with other dogs around, you know, by themselves, wind, no wind, all those considerations have to be evaluated before we make the ultimate of compliments to any of our dogs is they get to reproduce. So in a well-organized kennel, you have very, very few puppies, but very, very targeted bloodlines. Those are, I call them designer dogs. And because they're so far and few between, and they are so rare, and they are so wanted, it behooves us to interact with them at day one. You know, so from day one on, after they had been planned for sometimes decades, once the puppies are born, then we start working with them.
You know, that's good stuff. And I think any musher, any dog breeder could take that well-heeded advice and really start to optimize the way that they raise their dogs. One of the things that you mentioned there at the talk was the way that you go about training your dogs. And I know that there's a whole segment of how you train them before they get into harness and they start running and that sort of thing. But you mentioned that when you start training your dogs, you never stop at the same spot twice. And you mentioned that if you stop at a stump or a tree or whatever today, you won't stop at that same spot for another 365 days. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, that's the term I would call predictably unpredictable. And that's just a simple training method of, if the trainer needs to be or wants to be in charge, you stop and you do things on command, not by repetition. So a lot of people establish, and humanoids are real easily lulled into a routine. You might go out for, let's say, a 20-mile run, and you find that same tree after a 10-mile run, very convenient alongside the trail that you snub on in and you snack the dogs or you do something. And you fall into the habit of doing that pretty much all the time. Pretty soon the dogs will pretty much automatically stop at that tree. That doesn't teach the dogs nor the driver anything. So if we have stopped on that one tree once, we will never use that tree again, because we want our dogs to listen with the goal, of course, on Iditarod, you're never going to stop on the same tree more than once a year. Everything we do in training is geared towards Iditarod success. So we want our dogs to listen extremely well, and in order to do that, we start literally at day one. At day one of their puppy career, we often stick them in my shirt. I not only want the dogs to be used to being handled, I want them to be used to my smell, my rhythm, my sound, motion, and touch, of course. If you give me a puppy to hold, I automatically will rub their feet. And I joke, it's not because I have a foot fetish. It's simply because I want their dog's feet to be so desensitized from being pulled back that later on they can have booties put on, they can have their pads and their toes examined, not only by me, but by the veterinarians that will look at the dogs. And my dogs are every bit as ticklish on their feet as everybody else's dogs or everybody else's house pets. But my dogs have their feet messed with on a daily basis, and because of that, they don't mind having their toes and their pads examined. So everything goes, as I call it, goes back into the puppy pen. And I might share real quick that in my observations, I've heard the same story over and over. People will say, "Oh, my first litter was the best. Boy, when I got those pups, they were the best ever." And the subsequent litters, they didn't seem to be as productive or as good. And I beg to differ with those people. I would tell them, you know, you just had time for those puppies when you had the first litter because you didn't have a bunch of other dogs. So my advice to anybody that has a litter of puppies is provide as much time and donate as much energy as you did with your first litter to the subsequent litters, and they will all turn out great. And that means, of course, you have to have friends, helpers, kids, or awfully long days if you want to do it right and do the right thing by your puppy. So we spend an inordinate amount of time taking our puppies for walks, teaching them to run, teaching them to eat. In my puppy development, teaching them to eat is what I call opening their minds, and I have lots of video documentation of that. Once the puppies have become eager eaters, meaning they are fed in the puppy pens twice a day, they devour all the food readily and rapidly, simply because the feeder does the right thing. But if you have eight puppies, you put enough for seven in the trough, and they all go just a tiny bit crazy when that food is put down, because they know they better not be the eighth dog to start eating. So for a few weeks, we instill that eager eating habit, making sure that every morsel, every crumb, every cent of the food is gone by the time the dogs lift up their heads. And once that is instilled, that eager eating is instilled, then we introduce a very, very, very important aspect of the dog training, and that is we hold them back from the food. Not because we're cruel, not because we're want to get one over on them, but simply because I want them to focus on me, and I give the command to eat. And the first few times, of course, that delay of me putting the food down and the puppies are not allowed to eat is only a second or two, because that's all I can muster up to keep them from the food bowl, because all those previous weeks they were allowed to dive into the bowl. Now I start telling them no, and I hold them back from the food bowl, and then as I give them the command to eat, they dive into the food bowl. Now, being consistent and being on top of things, now I can vary the time from giving the command to eat, EAT is very important, to the point where I can literally have the dogs hover over the bowl, and they're so tempted to dive in, but they have learned that all positive reward comes out of my mouth. And I can actually walk away and eventually give them the command, eat, and they dive in and devour the food. That simple command of eating eventually will be phased out, because we have achieved what we wanted to achieve is the dogs have learned to listen to us. All guidance after that, all guidance comes from us, because we have opened their minds, as I call it, to listen to us. In fact, when you see them hovering over their food bowl, their nose, of course, knows exactly where the food is, but they're kind of peeking over at the trainer, mostly at me or one of my helpers. And once that command comes, they just dive into the food bowl, and it's a fantastic sight to see. And I might put it on my Facebook or something. I've got lots of clips showing just that, because it's a it's it's a mind-boggling experience, but it's in my life, it's so important that once the dogs have made that connection of immediate positive reward coming from the trainer's mouth, what else are they going to do? They're going to listen to you. They want to have more of that positive reward, that positive guidance that comes out of the trainer's mouth. And you literally will have opened their minds for future. Please tell me what to do. Let me know what I can do for you. And you always reward me positively. So let's have a great time. What do you want to do today? And that's what makes my life so fun.
And that's great stuff. Martin Booster, we're talking to tonight on Mushing Radio. You can check us out live on RadioFreePalmer.org and as a podcast on MushingRadio.com. If you can we step back just a second there, Martin? And you mentioned you hear a lot of folks say their first litter was the best, and you mentioned that it's because you had the time to spend with them. One of the questions I have for you is so many mushers, myself included, get into this sport. We get some dogs from whoever, and we typically get the adult dogs, dogs that have already proven themselves on the trail or whatnot. So we have a group of adult dogs, and they take up quite a bit of our time, but all of us want to breed that litter to start our own lines. I was wondering if you can give us some advice there. You know, we're into it with the adult dogs now, but we're ready to venture into starting up our own sets of puppies. What is some of the first types of advice you can give to those mushers that are starting down that path there?
Well, of course, you got to do your homework. You know, that's anytime you make the decision to have your dogs reproduce, the more informed decisions you can make, the better the outcome will probably be. Most likely, you will deal with an outcross, meaning the mom and the dad are probably not very closely related to each other, which is already a bit of a crapshoot. Your offspring is probably going to be like one of the grandfathers, like one of the mothers, like one of the uncles, one of the aunts. Outcrossing, unless they're really, really tightly line-bred individuals, will do just that. It's an outcross, and it will produce a big one, a little one, a black one, a white one, a gray one, and maybe two left-handed ones. So you just never really know what comes out of them. If you know the parents, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, and in my case, 10, 15 generations, you can make a more educated and informed genetic combination. Put that aside, you're going to have a bunch of puppies 63 days after initial contact, and you can pretty much set your clock to it. They're pretty much always on time, 63-day gestation, and the first interaction is you start cuddling those one-day-old puppies. You start carrying them around. At day two, you remove their dew claws because dogs don't climb trees anymore. The booty sits right where the front dew claws normally is, and they need to go just so you have a sound athlete in its adult life. Then you spend every waking moment, every hour that you can, sacrifice from your family or your job and spend it with your young dogs as much as you spend time with your old dogs, and raise them, challenge them, be consistent, do things with them. If you go to a race and the dog has never been in the truck before, that's not really the dog's fault, that's your fault. Sometimes when I know I go shopping, I go for an errand or something, oh guys, would you throw some puppies in my truck? Of course, I don't need to do anything with them. There might actually be a treat waiting for them in one of the dog boxes. We're just simply going to have fun, come back home, and have taught them to ride in the truck. And since it's all positive and exciting, what are they going to want to do? They want to go back in the truck. So we teach them the mundane, the benign, the tiniest little things because they need to become proficient at it. It's not just being a sled dog, it's being a well-rounded individual, a well-rounded dog.
And again, great stuff there, Martin. If you could share your philosophy, we have about 5 minutes left, just giving you a time time up there. What is your philosophy in terms of when these dogs are ready for racing? You often hear, this is a yearling team, this is my B team, this is my puppy team, et cetera. You'll hear those words from just about every musher. What is your philosophy behind that?
Yeah, you'll hear it a lot, but very, very, very few people actually do, certainly don't do the puppy program that we do. And let's go to the 2012 I did around where Matt Failer took our young dogs to Nome. None of his 16 starters had ever been more than a 300-mile race. All of them were under two. None of them had ever been on the Iditarod. 14 of them finished. I call it kindergartners going on a field trip. If you go on a long trip, you got to take the lowest common denominator and adjust the schedule to his or her ability to travel. If you take all pro athletes and you throw in one kindergartner, I guarantee you that kindergartner is going to wash up. Only if you take young dogs diligently and patiently as a separate unit, can you then, at the end of a trip like that, truly compare apples to apples. A lot of people say, oh, we're taking a bunch of yearlings to Nome, but they throw in four or five adult leaders. Well, invariably, of course, those adult leaders will overshadow or overpower those young dogs. Matt Failer ran every single one of those pups at least for one segment in lead. That's part of the mandate. That's part of the expectation. That's part of the yearling program. The youngest dog I've ever had was a dog named Frazier. He ran as a 13-month-old dog in the yearling program. Only because of an intense and very thought-out and methodically planned yearling season can the dogs then mature into the ultra-competitive team at 2.5. Since most of our dogs are born in the spring or summertime, they're always half when Iditarod comes around. So rule of thumb, at 1.5 years, you go to Nome, travel relaxed, slow, rest twice as much as you travel, have a good time. The very best ones of those graduates, as we call them, the graduates then mature into my competitive team, and as young as 2.5-year-olds have won the Iditarod in my team. But, of course, only because they had such a successful young puppyhood with lots and lots of miles, lots and lots of training, lots and lots of positive reinforcement. And then they can, you know, have a long career. The ultimate test, of course, is not so much the first or the second year, but how many Iditarods do they really run, you know? I have several dogs that are now pushing 10 that are still in my competitive team that might make it another year. So I think proof in the pudding is that the dogs have, because of good training and good development, have actually an extended working career rather than a shortened one.
Very good stuff there. And you had mentioned that starting out at that very slow pace with Matt Failer there running your dogs, that's becoming more of the norm where the mushers will have their handlers or somebody else run that yearling team. When did you start doing that, Martin? I'm sure you didn't have the luxury early in your career of having that second hand to help you out. When did you start implementing that into your system?
Well, I don't know. I've done it many, many years ago. I would have to go by the individuals, how many individuals I have trained to run the young dogs, but it goes way back to the certainly late 80s, maybe late 80s is probably the first time we started doing that. There might have been a couple of years here and there where we didn't have enough dogs or didn't have the wherewithal to put two teams in the race, but we have done it the aforementioned format for many, many years.
Very good. Martin, we're just about out of time. I do want to thank you very much for being on the show. It went very quickly. We definitely want to mention your website. It's booserdog.com. Anything else you want to mention in terms of contact?
Yeah, that's a good jumping off point. As I say, I don't do much with my website, but I do a lot on Facebook as of late. I have a couple of friends, and I post a lot of little funny things. And if I get nudged, maybe I do that. I put a little clip on how the dogs eat, or how I teach the dogs to eat on command. And I can think of a 2-minute little clip that I have on one of my computers that would illustrate that really well. And if I get requests for that on my Facebook, I befriend just about anybody. I'm easy, and I can easily be reached that way.
Sounds good. Martin, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Have a great day. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Martin Bucer, 4-time Iditarod champion and 29th competitor in the Iditarod. We do want to thank him for his time. We guys will see you guys next time. Goodbye.